Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
But God forgives us our weaknesses so long as we...
So long as we would. I haven't seen a sign of God lately. I mean, is he even listening?
Well, maybe his silence is essential to our free will.
I think that there has been a change in the basics of human nature. Something old, brutal, and hellish is here.
I don't think that you're crazy to think that.
You sense it. Nobody can do anything about it. It's like the darkness that hangs in the air even when it's sunny and light. It's like God just locked up and left. Adios.
And so what if he did, Lois? What if he's gone? What if that's exactly what he's done?
Big Daddy's left and gone on a business trip, so... We have the codes. We know the rules that goodness is governed by.
And maybe this is his way of telling us that it's time that we figure this shit out on our own.
He didn't just leave, Father. He left the keys to the candy store to the devil.
Happy heresy, then. Yes, I hope you like that clip, since it is the season of the witch, and some of you may be wondering, where is it from? That is from the Hulu series Grotesqueria, and so far it's excuse me, it's very entertaining, and again, it brings up some powerful philosophical issues, certainly some Gnostic issues, as you saw there. And hopefully, or when you see it, hopefully you certain powers that be haven't removed it for copyright reasons. But very, very good show. And I think is amazing about the show, besides the fact that it is extremely ultra violent, gross, and graphic. And every year I say, I'm not going to do this anymore, because they keep pushing the envelope. And every year it's a season I am watching horror movies and shows. I can't help it. But of all people that's in this very violent and visceral show, Travis Kelce is in the show. Now, why is Mr. Taylor Swift in this show? I don't know. You conspiracy and symbologists can figure that one out. I have to admit that he does a good job acting in the role he's acting, so I wouldn't mind seeing him some more. But yes, that is Grotesqueria, and it's got, again, powerful themes. We do have the codes. We are humanity, whether the gods or the animals are doing their things. We as human have our roles, and sometimes you do wonder, well, maybe God has left. Who's here? Who's in charge of this insane asylum? I don't know. Maybe it's like the Zoroastrian Zervanites, who Zervan, thanks to Mithra, you've got Ahriman and Ahura Mazda fighting, and he gives each god 1,000 years to rule the world. Maybe we're still with Kali and Ahriman. Who knows? Speculation. But anyway, my name is Miguel Connor. I am your Pompidus of Gnosis. Thank you very much for coming on this Saturn night. I am very excited to be joined at the virtual Alexandria by someone who certainly has the codes, has been working very hard on the codes and separating the light and the darkness, and that is Allison Gray. Allison, thanks for coming.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm really glad you perceive me that way, as having the codes. I hope everyone who's listening finds what we talk about today very valuable in that sense.
I have no doubt. I have enjoyed your work and your ideas, and they're certainly in line with this podcast and much of what's going on today. And with us, too, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm still debugging the codes.
But yeah, I figured out where that source of darkness that the priest was talking about. It's called the 2024 elections.
Oh my God! Yeah,
definitely. Talk about darkness.
It's coming too quickly. Like time feels like it's accelerating.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, stay sane, people. It's a big universe. Everything that's happened is part of a grand design. In fact, Allison will share how she's been swept away for a long time in these grand designs, but how to navigate. And even today, I was thinking, the world has gone crazy. I think the priest and the lady are right, because I was thinking today, you know what? Let's say I don't even know who Vance would vote for. And I realized I don't even care. If Vance said, I'm going to vote for Trump or Kamala or any of the third party candidates, I'd be like, oh, okay, whatever.
Your choice. Remember him?
Yeah. I'm going to vote for Cthulhu. I think he might be the wisest of all the
flying
creatures.
Flying spaghetti monster. Same guy.
People aren't looking at the big picture and the symbolism and the archetypes moving up above all this distraction. What do you think, Allison? Yeah, most of what we see in the news feeds and streams and the media it's ultimately a distraction from a bigger picture.
Oh, yeah. I tell people, I actually have a shirt that says there's like three check boxes. One is Democratic Party. One is Republican Party. And the final one is God's Free Energy Empire. And then I check that box on my ballot. I am only voting for a world of free energy where no human being has the right to rule over any other human being. I just fundamentally oppose that whole premise. And so I don't foresee myself voting at all. I think we vote with our energy. I think we vote with our actions and shift the culture that way. That's been a huge contemplation for me. You know, how much of our world that we're experiencing collectively is an after effect or an after image of what happened in here first. And I've definitely experienced that individually. But with this Helene thing that just happened, which I was in the middle of when I was in Nashville, it became more clear to me than ever how a collective can create a bigger picture all at the same time. And so now I find myself very fascinated and constantly contemplating how does the collective work? Because it's hard enough to have self-knowledge, right? And just know what's going on in your own subconscious. But on the collective subconscious level, forget it. It's enough to be crazy making, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, the most rewarding journey is the inner journey. That is an odyssey. It's a Tolkien novel in itself. So, and that's what we are in this world meant to do. So don't sweat all the superficial stuff, or just know it's all a story. It's all a narrative. It's all a fiction, like reality. So you mentioned Helena. Well, why don't we start there? I know we were chatting, getting the interview there. And then I'm like, I have like three people. I have close friends who live in Nashville, still talking to them in that area. And my jaw drops every time I talk to them. But I remember pulling up your Instagram. You're with some friends on top of some ruins and you're talking, we survived. But you had this really horrible news about people who dared the roads and sadly didn't make us. But tell us a little bit about that experience. It's incredible.
Yeah. I am very, very fortunate that I wasn't personally physically harmed and my property's okay. My car's okay. So I didn't lose nearly as much as other people did. However, the way it was very disturbing was, so I was living on this commune at the top of a mountain in Swannanoa. And, you know, the storm was getting crazy. It was really intense winds, really intense rain. So I was just safe in my Airstream with my cat. And I was everything's fine. And as the storm got more intense and the rain was running across our land in a way that I thought maybe might lead to some landslides, I decided to go to the central house with everyone else. And so we're talking and hanging out. And then we get a knock on the door after the peak of the storm ended and it was starting to calm down. We got a knock on the door from our up mountain neighbor. And he told us that he found a man hanging upside down the road from us. There was a slope of dirt alongside the mountain road. And so there had been a landslide. and it like wiped out the road. It the whole house just like slid down the mountain and unfortunately killed his wife inside of the rubble. And then the man, we're assuming that on the way down, as the house was going down, he got like crushed and pressed into the mud. So he was hanging upside down that way. And a bunch of neighbors like got called together to try to help him. And he just was too broken. And unfortunately, we witnessed him die. And that was day one. And I've never watched anyone die before. It was very disturbing, I think. And then, you know, the rain continued and the mud was like continuing to like flow through our land. And I, there's always that thought in the back of your mind of like, what if our house has a landslide next? So we're, you know, we're in that environment. Thankfully we had lots of food, lots of water. Like I find myself, I've never been in a disaster before. I keep thinking like, oh, I had no reason to be scared. And yet my heart was like pounding the entire few days we were there. I've just never experienced anything like this. And when we went down to the main street, it was just destruction, catastrophic destruction. Like this entire highway just like crumbled into the river. And yeah, it, I've never, ever seen anything like it. I hope I never do again. But what was outstanding to me personally, which, you know, I know not everyone has this kind of experience. So this is where I kind of veer off into a strange place with this experience. It felt like an initiation. It felt like a veil got ripped off of reality and I could suddenly see things in a metaphysical sense that I couldn't see before, including that feeling I was alluding to before of there being a collective sort of co-creation happening subconsciously. And I know how controversial and politically incorrect of a statement that is, especially in the face of so much death. But I think this is the kind of place where I can say something like that. Yeah, it was very clear to me, clearer than ever before, that even though we were all personally experiencing this disaster through our own filters, our own lenses, our own personal kaleidoscope, there was also the collective going through it together. And it was something that had to do with all of us very equally. And spiritually, so much was getting dredged up. And even to this day, it's been, has it been 2 weeks now that since the peak of the storm? Even more stuff is getting dredged up as a result of this disaster, like stuff in friendships and other relationships in my life. And it's like, this is not just some physical natural phenomenon. This is a very, very profoundly spiritual phenomenon, that this whole idea of a hurricane. And I explored that in some of my writing on Substack. You know, when I was there and we had no cell service, no internet, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go inward and try to uncover ancestral memories of hurricanes, because on my dad's side, I'm Puerto Rican. So hurricanes were central to their culture. They even had a Zemi named Guabantex, I think is how you pronounce it, who was the goddess of hurricanes and volcanoes, and earthquakes. And I went inward and I asked to be shown what exactly she is, what her function is, and how we're supposed to interact with her. And basically what I was shown was that while on the surface it looks so chaotic, it is actually a profoundly precise goddess, like, or force of consciousness that puts you exactly where your karmic trajectory was going to put you anyway, but it just accelerates it. So it's this giant spiral accelerator that just picks you up and throws you karmically where you were supposed to go. And you have to face whatever you've been trying not to face. And that was true for every single person I was dealing with during this storm. We all had stuff come up, like very personal stuff that had nothing to do with the hurricane, but needed to be dealt with right now. And so that was what I came away with after this experience, like this new understanding of just what is meant by we are nature, you know?
Yeah, thanks for sharing. Yeah, things happen on different levels, same as it ever was. I mean, you've been open about things like whether you're breaking up your boyfriend or whether I walk outside. There's different levels of reality in the universe is speaking with a message. So what you went through was certainly very intense. And as we spoke, I could relate. I lived in Houston for a long time, so I know the thing of looking out your window and everything is floating by. You're driving in the water's coming to your window. You're trying to get to some store or friend, and you're just, you know, the whole, the winds, the storm. But obviously, Houston obviously has the infrastructure and manpower to take these store, which it does all the time. Were you guys just caught by surprise, or what happened? It really
No one thought, because while we were up there on the mountain, we didn't know that at that moment, while we were hanging out and chilling, at the base of our mountain was 8 feet of river water, just like sweeping cars down the street, sweeping buildings down the street practically. It was intense. And and on that note of it being something we weren't prepared for, I was even talking with a friend, the kind of friend I could say anything to, like nothing's, you know, offensive. I was saying, like, something I think about a lot is our architecture and how it reflects our state of consciousness. And I want to be very careful saying this. I think even the fact that the architecture was not prepared for a disaster of this nature kind of betrays some degree of disconnectedness from the power of nature, like not really understanding the kinds of things that can happen. And of course, there would be people who say, well, this wasn't nature, this was weather modification. But even so, I mean, then that's a whole other conversation about how we collectively give our power away to if it's true that there are some elite controllers in the shadows making such technology, why were they even able to get to that point of power if not for our collective consent, even subconsciously, even coercively, you know?
Yeah, and if it was climate change, same conversation. Again, why are we taking ourselves to the brink and back to the drug? Why are we letting some mad gods be in control of our lives?
Yes.
Whether it's Zeus or some oligarch, it all ends the same, right? Destruction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we pay the price.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's so much to be said about personal power in this conversation. In fact, I was very happy to see a few people, instead of sharing like weather modification, fear mongering, were instead sharing ancient knowledge about how people used to do weather rituals, weather dances, weather songs, and actually kind of influence or shape the storms that would be happening around them, subdue the storms. That's a big part of my whole platform actually is human psychic and psionic potential. Right. And why is it that collectively we all used to know we could do this stuff? And now it's like, wow, you're schizophrenic. You know what I mean? Like it's, how did we get here? How did we get here to being okay with saying the technology has the power, but thinking it's crazy to say our spirits have even greater power to influence reality? You know, I'm a stickler about this stuff. I don't concede any ground to giving technology any kind of power that we don't have.
Yeah, well, isn't it as simple as they want to separate us from our source, from nature, from the goddess, from our intrinsic divine spark? Because it's easier to control us that way, and then it's easier to get us into this cult of the death.
We can't control them. Material. See,
yeah,
that's the problem. If we were powerful, they'd have to be worried. They couldn't perpetrate, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. And we have to consent to the perception of ourselves as powerless in order for them to be able to do any of this stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the most taboo things to even suggest that we are gods or have godlike potential. You know, I'm iffy on how to express that exactly, because I do think the word God has like distinguishing qualities. Like I can't part the ocean right now at will, but I think humans have the capacity to get there with their development of psionic power. So I would say we are like potential gods or embryonic gods or something to that effect. But I think step one to even starting to see the kind of power that is dormant within us is accepting that it's there and giving ourselves permission to embrace it. I think one of the biggest taboos in this world is talking about human psionic potential. Like there's just this automatic like shutting down of conversations like that. Like, oh, that's crazy. That's narcissistic. That's vain. You know, it's like, why would it ever be wrong for people to just be powerful? I've never been convinced that there's anything wrong with these conversations.
And now they're scientific. I mean, astral travel, near-death experience, psi capabilities. I mean, the data is there and it is sound. Just pick up a Mitch Horowitz book and or Colin Wilson, you'll get all the scientific facts there. But I think maybe they're knowing this and they're like, this is a time when we need to prune. We need to really bring the hammer down because, like you said, if we wake up, they're going to be in trouble because we will be united. I mean, even something like, let's say where you are, I remember reading this research by Richard Smoley. He said there was this experiment where they would get 20, 30 people meditating on a neighborhood in a city. Wherever they meditated, the crime went down statistically.
Yes.
I mean, this is scientific. So yep.
I cite that study all the time. And cool. I've seen smaller YouTube creators do their own versions of those experiments. There's this one, I don't know if his name was Wayne J. Bush or on YouTube.
Yeah, Wayne Bush.
Yeah, he his city, if I'm remembering who it was, his city was going through a drought for a long time and like plants were dying and it was pretty dire. And he asked his YouTube following to just concentrate on the image of it raining heavily in his area. And then I think within 3 days of him asking people to do that regularly, it started downpouring after this huge drought. And I live for stuff like that. That's the stuff that keeps me going. And I'm always trying to ask people to like, do stuff like that with me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to sit around afraid of the Illuminati. Like, I want to.
No, we all have so much power. We just don't realize it. We've forgotten, each one of us. We all have a purpose, a destiny, a talent, a gift. And again, all this power. I mean, and again, this is part of nature. If a dog can detect an earthquake 8 hours away, that's nothing. It's just instinct. And you see animals again, they have this collective that helps the species powers, and they can do things, whether it's the march of the monarch butterfly. Anyway, nature is so full of this stuff. It's
well, you know,
it's, we humans are different.
I did something like this once, and I'm not sure why this was a particular time, but I was on a workshop in the Big Island of Hawaii, and we were on a boat going on the way to Captain Cook's Cove, and we were supposed to do some snorkeling, but we couldn't snorkel if it was raining. Okay. And it was raining all the way to the Captain Cook's Cove. So the leader of the workshop, who fancied himself a magician, says, "Hey Vance, why don't you make it not rain?" You know? And I think he was like saying, it's, you know, as a poke at me. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, and I thought, "Hey, weather gods, will you do this with me?" And they said, "Yeah, okay." I said, "All right, I'll do it." So anyway, I ask the weather gods, "Okay, please, you know, clear up the weather around the cove." So we got there, and literally, just as we got there, the clouds parted away in a circle over this cove, and the cove is circular shaped. And we snorkeled for an hour that way. And
I after the hour,
no, this is a true story.
Yeah.
And then right at the end, it started raining a little bit. We got back on the boat. And, you know, I don't know what they thought of it, but he says, "All right, make it not rain all the way back." And I looked at him and says, "No, you're not going to manipulate me that way."
Yeah.
That's lovely. And I have a secondhand story very similar to that. I had a friend who, this was during 2020, and there were a lot of protests going on in major cities around the world of the lockdowns, like people gathering in huge spaces, just to say, "You can't make us stay home. Like, who are you?" And, and I can attest that there were some weird chemtrail things happening over our heads. When I would go to protests in New York City, that's where I was at the time. There would be like very strange symbols being drawn in the sky, like sigils and glyphs and stuff. And it seemed like something occult was being done over the crowds. Mm-hmm. And so I had a friend in London who was reporting the same thing. And she said her and her friends got together in a circle and started meditating on clear skies. And right over their heads, those chemtrails just broke up and dissolved. And I was like, because it works. And that's why I won't entertain all the fear mongering, whether it's about the election or the weather or whatever. I just, because we ultimately, if we actually do want a better world, it's us who has to create it. Like, we are responsible.
Yeah. I agree. And somebody who was very good at manipulating weather was Elvis. in my book, I think four examples, and he was never alone. This is with groupies, family, Memphis Mafia. He could just look up at the sky and he could make clouds part. And it was no big deal to him, you know, if he was out and people were like, oh, it's raining, Elvis. He'd be like, oh, thank you. I'll take care of it. And he would do this thing he learned and he would just make the rain stop and the clouds part. So, yeah.
Yeah. Don't rain on my blue suede shoes.
Right? Yeah, exactly. He never had to worry about writing that song. Yeah. That's the one thing.
Yeah. Oh, I love, yeah, we were talking earlier about how so many celebrities have these kinds of powers. Like, was it Jimi Hendrix who was like telepathic and he would speak to his friends telepathically? That's another thing. Like, it was one of these like huge musicians in that era who.
Bowie believed in that and he did that. And
oh, yeah.
He loved it. He could read people's minds. Same with Elvis. Bowie carried a tarot with him.
I've definitely spoken telepathically with loved ones, and I've also seen other people do it right in front of me. And it's like, you know, I've had so many experiences like this in my life of precognition through dreams or just like flashes of insight. I think I had one stint with telekinesis, but I was alone and I can't prove that it happened. So take that for what you will. And so many other examples of like these sorts of powers coming through in a flash. And it's for that reason that I'm always talking about, like, I put it this way, humans can fly, and I'm here to remind people of that. Mm-hmm. It just seems logical to me that if all these other little powers are possible, then this one big ultimate freedom of flight must also be possible. So, yeah, that's kind of my like fixation, my obsession in my body of work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And definitely check out her Substack. I'll have the links. And she also has a donate if you want to help her financially. She also gave me some links of other places there in that area, which I will put in the show notes. So please give some, because yeah, people are, I'm talking to my friends and it's still a complete disaster. It's still a mess. There's so much. And unfortunately we live in this era where it's like the news cycle. Now everybody moved to Milton. Then everybody's going to move to the election and we forget these things. So let's not forget, because again, not only that's how they take our power. They make us forget, and we forget easily. If we don't forget, we honor them and we can help them.
Forgetting, that's such an excellent point. Forgetting is a big part of how power is taken. I think it could be argued that this whole realm operates on us having forgotten how we got here. And yeah. You know, so then that lends itself to us being sort of louche farmed, as they say. Yeah, but I will say, while you brought up the aftermath of the hurricane again, I am really like heartwarmed, I don't know a better phrase for it, by all the goodness I'm seeing in those areas, people really pulling together. I mean, me and my landmates, it was such a blessing to be with them specifically. We got along so harmoniously. Everyone's different skills came together in like the best possible way for us to take care of each other while we were stranded. And everything I'm hearing out of Asheville, which is where I'm connected to, is just like people finding huge, heavy equipment and machinery for people to build their own roads again, because the city's been so slow, and stuff like that, you know, donating generators for people who have like oxygen tanks and need electricity. There's so much good that comes out of us that I don't think is going to get covered on the media, because it discredits, you know, the federal agencies that are not doing what they should be doing. So,
yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Or again, we got to move to the next divide and conquer news story. So, yes. And with us, for those of you just joining, we've got Allison Gray. She's our first homeless guest. So it's like, so it's nice to talk. She's got a shopping cart next to her. No, you are. Yeah, you were literally displaced. You are now no longer.
Yeah, I'm staying in my family house now. It's funny. The whole experience was so dreamlike. It was truly like being in another dimension. And while I was in Asheville, I adopted my cat. And
your cat's fine.
The cat's fine. Yeah, she was a little pissed at me with all the moving around we did at first. But I think she's figured it out that we're like settled in now. Yeah, what was so funny was Asheville was already very bizarre and dreamlike for the 4 months I was there. And then during the actual storm, it was truly like being in a liminal dimension. It was like so trippy and weird. And then when my parents came to pick me up from where we evacuated to, and drove me back home. The next day I woke up in what was my old bed, but my mom redecorated the whole room while I was gone. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it just almost felt like, oh, so Asheville was a dream. I was just here.
Like the end of the Wizard of Oz or something.
But then there was a cat next to me. So I guess the cat followed me out of the dream and into Chattanooga.
The Matrix, deja vu. The cat's there for your deja vu.
Oh, so. Yeah. And she's chilling. I kind of hope she makes a little guest appearance at some point.
Everybody knows here, I probably have about 5 cats hiding somewhere in the room. So.
I've seen one of them on another episode, so I'm excited to see the others.
Yeah, we love animals here.
Yeah, sure thing. Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that.
Yeah.
No hassle.
None.
That is super convenient. Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
And I know right now it's probably hard to pick out all the symbolism. I mean, I was thinking of Helena. So, of course, I'm thinking Helena, the moon, Simon Magus's consort, sorceress. But that's obviously my mythology and sinks. But and it was a strange name. And it's very hard at the time. I mean, like the other day, Allison, I was meditating, and then I realized I had, you know, those insights where you see and suddenly you see the entire story of what happened from one end to the other, and you see how there was a providence. I was like, all this randomness in 2022, I looked and it was a harmonious movement into an action I was meant to take. And I was like, that it's so obvious that this is what the spirits were doing at the time. I was like, oh, randomness and oh shit and this and that. But it was so obvious. But it took a while for me to get it. Do you think, are you seeing any sort of pattern yet? Or are you just sort of going to wait till it comes to you?
Oh yeah. I started seeing the pattern on day 3 because what Hurukan brought up, and that's, you know, my ancestral mythology. What she hurled me into was facing my familial karma, because there's this whole saga, and I explain more on Substack, where this house was something I invested in with my family. So the thing is, like, there were a lot of like verbal agreements that we made in trust that then did not turn out to be in practice like what it was like to own a house with my family. Mm-hmm. So then I tried to get out of the mortgage, and the bank was like, no, you can't, because of like, there were all these different financial factors. So I kind of ended up stuck with this house on my financial records, like making my debt to income ratio like way too high. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, oh God, like I'll never own my own property. I'll never be able to move on from this family. And like, and then near the end of living together, things really came to a head with my mom, and I estranged myself from her. So when I went to Asheville, it was mainly to get away from her and try to build my own life. And what ended up happening during the storm was, in all these really subtle, precise roundabout ways, I was brought face to face with like, oh, I understand. I have to go back home. I have a karmic debt. Right. You can't just run away from that. And I'm not, I hope everyone understands, I'm not saying anyone else who's estranged from a family member, like, you just have to go talk to them. No, that was, for me personally, that was what I discerned was the right course of action. And I came back here. And interestingly, the cat who followed me out of this strange dream is like the peacemaker in the house. Like, it's very symbolic that like my mom hated black cats. Like, she thought that they were ominous and that it was a sign someone was doing bad witchcraft on you or whatever. And obviously I'm an occultist, so I'm not scared of that shit. So I was like, yeah, bring on the black cat. So, I used to joke that Jupiter, my cat, and my mom, the reason Jupiter came into my life in Asheville was because they couldn't exist in the same dimension. Like, this cat would only come into my life after I left my mom. But then, now that I'm back here, my mom's obsessed with Jupiter. She's in love with Jupiter, and Jupiter loves her back. And I feel like whatever tension I was expecting to come back home to is just not there. And I do feel like this strange little cat creature, magical being, had something to do with sort of untangling some of that karma for both of us. So yeah, I don't know. That's a very personal, like, so far, that's what I've deduced about, like, the purpose of this storm for me as an individual. On the collective, I got in trouble with somebody for suggesting that there was a collective karma that was being addressed. So I want to step very carefully here. But it did feel like there was something, at least in Asheville, something that was being worked out on the collective level, where you had this city full of seekers of, like, different stripes, like Buddhists and pagans and Christians and, you know, all the different kinds of faiths, everybody's searching for the truth. And it seemed like this hurricane really showed us the truth, which is, well, you need each other to survive. So go ahead and experience that right now. And that was what I deduced from it. That's my personal perspective on the matter. But I know not everyone's going to see it that way, but it seems, I don't know, it just seems so obvious to me. Like, it makes so much sense that for Asheville, at least, that was part of, like, the purpose behind Helene.
Yeah, well, you are right. It is one of the most magical occult places, definitely in the South, easily. Mm. So it's, that's where everybody goes. So, and it's a great lesson of the power of the randomness of nature. I mean, we are meant to be connected to nature, but she has her agenda, and it's brutal. There's a darkness and a light to this force. So it's not all, you know, unicorns and rainbows and, oh, I'm going to work on my shadow and do my astrology chart. No, I mean, nature is, it's awe. It's awe and fear.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that we live in a civilization really amounts to us depending on each other in an impersonal level. But when things like this happen, now we see us depending on each other in a personal level, heart to heart, as opposed to mind to mind. So, you know, so that's a big difference. So that's a big lesson right there.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Connecting at the heart level was definitely not something I was doing with my landmates. They were just kind of like people I lived on the same land with. But then after this, it was like, we all fell in love with each other. Like I could suddenly see God in them. Like, wow, these people are so beautiful and so powerful. And I can't believe I didn't see it before, you know? So I would say Helene also felt like a revealer of many things at once, many things, not just like literally physically with like revealing the weaknesses in the infrastructure of our city and stuff, but also spiritually, like revealing so many relationship dynamics that we couldn't see before. And yeah, honestly, I could trip out talking about this one hurricane and the fact that there are people who live in the path of hurricanes and experience this regularly. I mean, you were saying that that was your experience when you lived in Texas, or do you still live there? In Houston?
No, not anymore. It's been a while, yeah. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I have been thinking, because I tapped into my ancestral memory during this experience, I was thinking, well, I guess everywhere you live in nature, there's going to be something that you have to deal with, like whether you're living in a hurricane path or in tornado alley, or if you're living in a desert, there's certain things that come with that biosphere. If you're living in a rainforest, there's certain risks and dangers that come with that biosphere, and all of it's going to be reflecting you back to you. And there was a time, I think, where it seems like we had our pockets of developing genetic memory that would like be on the land for a long time and have a certain karmic trajectory. But in this day and age, so many people live all over the place and not where they have their genetic, like karmic baggage. So I don't even know why I brought that up. I don't even know where to start on like what that entails for us and like the growth of our souls. But I imagine a lot of our modern day confusion stems from just like not being home. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Very true. Very true. Yes. And if you have a question for Allison, please super chat them so we can get to them. We got super a big chat. Crowd tonight. It's Saturday. Usually we have a slow crowd, but yeah, everybody's here to see you. Over 100 people here and there. And you were talking. Yeah, I think the next thing is about we were just talking, and that's chaos. That's something you've worked with. You are a chaos magician.
Yes.
And you're into chaos theory. So tell us, how did you get started and how does chaos play into it? And of course, people are going to get mad because I'm going to quote that line from Game of Thrones, chaos is a ladder. From
I've never heard that before.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's from I forget the who's the guy, one of the creeps, Littlefinger. He goes, chaos is a ladder. There's a famous speech in Game of Thrones about it.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, intuitively that makes sense. There's, you know, to be cliche, there is an order to chaos that you only see if you go looking for it. Because if you just, you know, look at the disorder and are like, oh, I hate this. I want order again. Like, you're going to miss the point. So, okay, where to start on my journey with chaos theory and how I define myself as a chaos magician. When I was maybe 12 or 14, somewhere around that time, I started becoming obsessed with the word chaos. Like, I could actually feel its vibration differently than other words. I was very drawn to it. It felt so strong and like something that was drawing me in. So I started studying it. And at the time, I didn't know what the word gnosis was. I just knew that I was getting insights that I wasn't learning from other people. So it's not like I studied under like Robert Anton Wilson or Austin Osman Spare. It was just like things were coming up from my own internal worlds that we're forming this cohesive picture of what chaos is and its function in the universe. And then I wanted to get, I found out about the symbol called the chaos star. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, that's me. Like, I don't know how to explain it, but I was like, I'm looking at myself. So I decided I wanted this tattoo really bad. I planned it for 6 years. So everyone knew I was serious. Like, I was telling everyone I'm going to get this tattoo. And then I got the tattoo. And a few years later, and let me explain something about this tattoo. So it's the thing in my image, which was, right. You guys have seen it. It's the 8 arrows pointing outward from a center. And my idea was that this image suggested that the arrows would always come back to their source, right? So they're always still connected to the center. So that said, a few years later, when I was introduced to Vedic astrology, I found out that my sun is in Punarvasu Nakshatra, which is the portion of the sky ruled by the deity Aditi, whose symbol is the quiver of magical arrows that always return to their source.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I just intuited that for years before I found out that, like, according to Vedic astrology, I am the goddess Aditi in human form. Because right. That's what I love about Vedic astrology, that it's like, it sees the power in people. It's not just like, oh, are you a crabby Cancer? Or like, you know, it's so much deeper and richer than that. So all of that background given about like my intuitive trajectory with chaos, the way I understand it is chaos is essentially the bridge to free energy. And free energy is just that which is not limited, that can't be limited by the laws of physics or anything of that sort. So free energy defies our idea that there has to be a cause and effect, that what goes up must come down. And like all these things we take for granted as being the way things work, chaos throws that all into question and shows us that actually there is a way that things can work that isn't based on these like cycles or patterns. And so free energy, you know, I joke about, but I'm not joking, wanting to live in a free energy empire. Free energy would basically be the antithesis to the control system,
right.
The control system of trying to enslave people or make people operate under mind control. Free energy is freedom. It's exactly what it sounds like. Free energy is love. And a society built on or built by free energy would look very, very, very different from this like energy leeching matrix that we think is just how it has to be. So when I call myself a chaos magician, what I'm really saying is I am someone who is personally very seriously invested in studying how to tap into free energy. And so, you know, I recently sort of soft launched the Church of Immortality, which is my personal means of preserving what I believe was Jesus Christ's true message, assuming he was real, which I do. I think he was actually teaching free energy. Like, for example, the story I love to call on for this, to illustrate this, is how he took two fish and five loaves of bread, or the other way around?
Yeah, it was one of those, yes.
Yeah, it was one of those. So he took some bread and some fish and then was able to feed 5,000 people. Right. So he essentially pulled food out of thin air. That flies in the face of the idea that food has to be grown in the ground and then harvested and then processed and then cooked. And then, like, there, no, actually it can be instantaneous. Your true nourishment comes from the ether. It does not come from the physical world, and it is not limited to the laws of physics. And he was showing that food is not physical, ironically, through the vehicle of physical food. And so it's that kind of free energy that he was actively encouraging people to tap into. And unfortunately, a lot of people saw that and were like, oh, well, I guess we'll just worship you instead, you know, and that's not what he said. So yeah, I'm a big fan of Jesus the Christ, and I believe his miracles were a demonstration of what we're capable of when we let go of this idea that things have to work the way they currently work, which is like a dead energy system. Free energy is living energy, and I'm obsessed with it.
You know, that's very interesting. I know, like, the Valentinians used to say Jesus was the perfect human being. This is Valentinus the Gnostic. He said he was in perfect balance, and this his body would regulate itself, so he wouldn't have to sweat or poop or pee, pardon, but so therefore he didn't have to eat. He was just a perfect self-sustaining, the perfect man, which is what you're supposed to be. So that it might have been up in the air back then, Allison. So.
There are some clues in the Gospels that he didn't eat normal food. He said in one verse, when one of his disciples asked him if he'd eaten something, he said, "I have food to eat that you know nothing about." Mm-hmm. And given the context of the rest of his life and some of his practices of, like, eliminating parasites from the body or from the bodies of others, it seems to me that he was in a pranic state of, like, he could eat, but he didn't have to because he was nourished by the ether and by mana from heaven, as they call it. And so that's another layer of this, like, free energy thing. Humans actually don't need to eat. We want to, and we are very accustomed to the point where it's kind of addictive, and we think we have to, right? And so, but, you know, all of my encounters with breatharians and people living in the pranic state have taught me that actually, we are so powerful, we don't even need food. And, like, this is the kind of stuff I've, like, devoted myself to understanding and talking to people about, because if you knew how free you were, like, you would, like, never worry about this stuff again. And I still worry about stuff in life, but I think I'm getting better at not worrying about stuff, you know, because the more I focus on these things that I know to be true, the less worried I am about the state of the world, or, like, how much power I have within this world, you know?
Wow. So you've met breatharians. I would love to.
Yeah.
I've heard of them, but I've never actually met. My wife studied it for a while and she was into it, but just haven't gotten into it.
I got my breatharian initiation 2-3 years ago. It was maybe 3 Halloweens ago at this, because it was on Halloween. The veil was very thin, and I took advantage of that to ask, like, God, like, what is my spiritual path? I'm sick of everyone telling me, like, do this yoga or, like, do this mantra. Like, I just, what is for me, right? And then what sprang up instantaneously was this instant revelation of, like, eat light, eat light, eat light. That was all I heard, just, like, reverberating in the atmosphere. And I knew that that meant ultimately, you know, be in a pranic state, and there's going to be a journey to get there. That is my path. And so it lends itself to all these other things I've been mentioning, like free energy and personal power and things like this, undoing of the idea that food is where my energy comes from. It's not like nothing in this universe is nourished by food. And I know that's a radical statement, but the breatharians I've encountered to different degrees, like, there's some people who just go long times without eating and don't need to eat much.
Right.
There's people who just, like, fast regularly. So I was fasting weekly for about a year, and then I kind of fell off. So when I got to Asheville, interestingly, so it's time for me to get back on my path. But someone in the comments, which I did not know were a thing until just a few seconds ago, somebody started mentioning parasite cleanse related stuff over here. And that's a big thing you confront on the pranic journey. It's a lot of what actually makes us think we're hungry is parasites in our bodies, that they're the ones eating, and we don't need to eat nearly as much as we think we do. It's the parasites.
They're pulling the levers, the chemical switches. Oh,
yes. Oh, they are. And in fact, there are some, there are some censored verses in the Gospels where, Jesus Christ, I think the Geneva Bible still has these verses where there were some people so tormented by demons and possessed by demons that he said they would have to fast, and that was the only cure. And the implication being to starve out the parasites. Right. But then those references to fasting were removed in later translations, which is like interesting. Like, who doesn't want us to know how to remove parasites from our bodies? You know what I mean? Or that or the relationship between fasting and demon possession.
Right.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. And even, I mean, it's not that rare. You look at, for example, movements like the Jains in India, and then the Gnostic Manichaeans were the same way. They would not touch grass. They would have both, again, the Manichaeans and the Jains were, you wipe things so they don't step. They hated breathing because they didn't want to breathe and kill bugs. They barely ate. So they lived these ultra ascetics live. The Jains are still around, and they're very known as very holy, intelligent, and really well-adjusted people.
Yeah. And I was thinking about the Jains this morning too, because I knew we'd at some point talk about parasites. And I was thinking how interesting it is that every religion on earth has a sect that attempts to stop causing things to die altogether. Right. So the Jains don't want to eat anything that was ever alive, which is such a noble, like, and then there's fruitarians who, you know, they eat fruits because you don't have to kill a fruit. It's just, you know, hanging off the tree. And so there's somewhere, I think, in our collective memory as humans, we understand that we maybe once belonged to a dimension that you might call Eden or the Pleroma or what have you, where death was not a feature of that dimension. And it came in later. So death is actually foreign to us. As much as we may tell ourselves death is necessary or death is inevitable, or you just have to embrace it or accept it, whatever. Like, I think somewhere deep down, we know that's not true. And that's why we remain generally disturbed by death. I know not everybody is, but I think the fact that we have to try so hard to accept death says that maybe we aren't supposed to. But that's the immortalist in me talking. So I know this is where I'm like super fringe, even for like spiritual communities. Like,
you're a heretic even among heretics.
Yes. Yes.
Indeed. What do you think, Vance? Do you have questions or comments?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the idea of, you know, getting away from the energy, matter, energy, space, time type of, you know, prison that we're in. So what other kinds of things do you do, Allison, to, you know, transcend, pierce the veil, so to speak, to try to bring in the zero point energy into your practice?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And I would say only recently did I put it together that love is free energy. And that is why I believe Jesus was preaching both. You know, he said, the signs of those who believe in me will be that they will love one another and like show my love to the world. And then the other signs will be, you'll be able to pick up snakes and be bitten by them and they won't hurt you. And you'll be able to, like, you know, tread on scorpions. And so it was like he was positing that love and superpowers are the same, because love is the freest energy and it breaks all karmic ties. It breaks all patterns. And, So I can't say I'm like a master at this, because I only just recently realized, oh yeah, love is like really important. But I am trying to practice love more. And for me, that looks like radical generosity. So I read this book I really love called The Treasure Principle. I believe it was Randy Alcorn who wrote it. And he put it forward that, like, the reason Jesus preached so much about wealth and possessions was because if you're still thinking that money is your source of everything you need in life, you are totally missing all the other ways that like provision can be made for you by the universe at large. So it's like once you detach and like just give away what you think is yours, then you'll see how much more comes in seemingly out of nowhere. And I have definitely been experiencing that the more I just like stop caring about my possessions, like whatever, it's temporary. Nothing in this world is really mine. And that's a big lesson Helene taught me. Like now that I'm more comfortable with like not being too attached to just physical objects, and giving stuff away to people who need it more than I do, I find that like all my needs are met in these very mysterious roundabout ways that maybe I wouldn't have been open to before. So I'm starting to see that as a way to tap into free energy. You know, there is this constant churning exchange of energy going on around us at all times. But when we become rigid and attached to like one way of things coming to us, we sort of like block out all the other channels of reception. So detachment's a big one. And detachment is such a heavy word for me because I think of it as like, oh, monks who've detached from everything and like gone to the mountains to meditate forever. Right. Like I don't see myself doing that, but
then they're attached to meditating in the mountains.
Yeah. That's true. It's a trap.
Yeah.
It's a trap from Star Wars.
Yeah. I'm going to make myself free by imprisoning myself in a monk cell.
There you go.
Yeah. There's always that shadow lurking around the corner of like, well, why are you really doing this? You know?
So what are your practices? You just contemplation, meditation, or what practices do you do?
I do love to meditate. There's a million ways to meditate, so that doesn't really narrow it down, but like I like to ask a question and then see what answers come up within me. And then also I love paying attention to like, I guess it's like an ongoing mindfulness of like how my inner state then ripples out into something physically manifest. So my state of being, how it lends itself to new people coming into my life, the kinds of conversations that start happening around me and things like that. I wouldn't say I have a traditional spiritual practice. I think fasting was my practice for a while until I fell off that wagon. But yeah, that ongoing mindfulness. I'm into dream work too. That's been, oh man. I don't even know if it's as fruitful as I was hoping it would be. Sometimes I hear people say stuff about like how the archons like use dreams or synchronicities to like fuck with us. And I sometimes with the way my dreams are, I start to wonder if that's true. And I'm
really
like, yeah, because like stuff will happen where like even just a few months ago, right before I left for Asheville, I had a dream about this guy. And it was like, he felt like, I don't know, maybe not my soulmate, but he felt like someone very significant who I had profound trust in. And I felt very safe and protected by him in the dream. And then the next day, I walked into a restaurant and I met him. And I was like, whoa, like, and I'm where he's talking to me, like he struck up a conversation with me that felt a little flirty and I just could not words. Like I like, how do you tell someone, hey, I saw you in my dream last night. And felt like you can't, I mean, you can, we have free will, but I wasn't going to. So I just, it was like, and then I moved to Asheville and I never saw this guy again. It was like, what was the point of that? I mean, then again, I'm back in Chattanooga. So if I was crazy, I would show up at that restaurant and like try again, but I'm not going to stalk a man at work.
That's what social media is for.
I can find out what his name is. But it's stuff like that, that it's like, well, what was the point of that dream? What was the point of that precognition? I mean, sure, there's still the future. Something could still unfold.
Yeah, the loop could close somewhere else.
Yeah. So who knows? But it's stuff like that that makes me not want to just like throw myself into trusting my dreams just yet. It's like, well, what is this for? Like what, you know? So I have more questions than answers, I think.
Well, something I think that might work instead, and Jung did write about it. He says, the problem with dreams, it is a passive way of talking to your soul or God or the spirits, but there is a risk with some people that it will let in complexes and shadows in and take over. So he advised doing active imagination, like what you're doing, because you're probably more energetic, or you, like you said, you like to go outward. So he said active imagination is more active and gets you to take control of the wheel. So I think that you might want to try that instead.
It just occurred to me that maybe the dream was designed to protect you from this person, because if you hadn't had that dream, he probably would have been flirty anyway, and you might have, you know, started a relationship with him that wouldn't be good. So the dream made you alert to his presence. And I do you feel like that dream possibly prevented you from talking to him, or you know, taking it a step further?
Ooh, that's a good question.
He's not on a true crime podcast.
I hope not. Yeah. Did the dream prevent me from talking to him? I mean, knowing me, if I hadn't had that dream and then I'd met him and he started flirting with me, maybe I wouldn't have flirted back. I think I was just very nervous in general. Like, he was very attractive and I don't think I would have had the courage to talk to him. I think the dream just complicated that, like, and added a layer of meaning that wouldn't have been there before. I don't know. I guess it's just one of those, like, that's another timeline that I am not private.
Yeah. Something to think about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.